Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Michael Fullilove. I'm the Executive Director of the Institute. Thank you all for joining us here at Bligh Street for today's event with the Chief of the Australian Army, Lieutenant General Angus Campbell. And let me recognise a number of old friends in the Institute. Well, there are a number in the audience, but let me recognise in particular Mick Keelty, former Commissioner of the Australian Federal Police and a good friend of mine and the Institute. Thank you for joining us, Mick. Ladies and gentlemen, when you visit the War Memorial in Canberra, I think a casual glance helps you to discern the history and pattern of our military deployments abroad. You can see it in the names of the 100,000 Australians who have died in uniform, whose names are inscribed in bronze on the Roll of Honour. But you can also see it in the cloisters of the memorial, which list the distant theatres in which those Australians served, including the Sudan, South Africa during the Boer War, and China during the Boxer Rebellion, the Dardanelles, northern France, Flanders, Mesopotamia, Egypt and Palestine in the First World War, Greece, Crete, North Africa, Burma, Malaya, Papua and New Guinea in the Second World War, and Korea, Vietnam, East Timor, Afghanistan, Iraq and elsewhere since then. Australia has always seen itself as a security provider. We've always seen ourselves as a security contributor. We've always seen ourselves as a global power, a country that whose interests are not limited strictly to our immediate region. And the Australian Army has always been the tip of the spear when it comes to Australia's security contributions abroad. In light of a global order that seems to be unravelling and a region that is increasingly troubled in security terms, we need a capable, muscular defence force that is able to protect the full breadth of our interests. In the past decade, you might have expected Canberra to, in light of these factors, to increase its military power. But instead, Canberra cut defence spending as a proportion of our GDP to its lowest point since before the Second World War. As defence budgets in Asia waxed, ours waned. The vision for the ADF that was sketched out in this year's White Paper was therefore welcome in the sense that the government treated these issues with rigour and seriousness. The White Paper highlighted the rise in defence spending in our own region. Asia's defence spending is now larger than Europe's. The document also projected that by 2035, China's defence spending would be on a par with America's, and in the same year, Indonesia's defence spending would be on a par with ours. And I think the lesson from that is that for Australia, the era of cheap security is over. Ladies and gentlemen, Lieutenant General Campbell has had a distinguished career in the Australian Army and the Australian government. He's also a deep thinker about our strategic environment. Lieutenant General Campbell joined the Australian Army in 1981. In 2001, he was appointed to lead the 2nd Battalion of the Royal Australian Regiment, which deployed to East Timor as part of UNTAYET. From 2005 to 2010, he served in several national security roles within the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, rising to the position of Deputy National Security Advisor. He returned to the ADF as a Major General in 2010, and in 2011, he assumed command of all Australian forces deployed in the Middle East. He served as Deputy Chief of Army in 2012 to 2013, when he took command of the Joint Agency Task Force responsible for the implementation of Operation Sovereign Borders. Angus was appointed Chief of the Australian Army on the 16th of May 2015, where we've hosted you before, Angus. You're always welcome at the Institute. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Lieutenant General Campbell to the lectern.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. And Michael, thank you very much for that kind introduction. Could I first acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we are meeting today, the Cadigal people, and pay my respects to their elders both past and present. I really appreciate the invitation to speak here at Lowy. The Australian perspective that you bring to international policy issues is always very well regarded. And so coming here to one of Australia's flagship think tanks is a privilege, and I deeply value the opportunity. The 2016 Defence White Paper places Australia's security firmly within the maritime environment of the Indo-Pacific region. This reflects a bipartisan continuity of strategic thinking about our place in the world. The Australian Army contributes to our nation's security and has done so mostly as an expeditionary continental army for most of its history. This includes the operations in Afghanistan and Iraq during the last 15 years, also Vietnam, Korea, and much of both world wars. While I don't forget the divisional scale combined amphibious operations of the Southwest Pacific campaign of the Second World War, I note the introduction into service of the landing helicopter dock vessels, HMA ships Canberra and Adelaide, in concert with other advanced naval, air and land platforms, provides a very substantial increase in the modern Australian Defence Force's potential for amphibious operations, ranging from humanitarian assistance to warfighting. So when preparing this address, I was initially interested in thinking about speaking about the implications for the Army of designing a land force both required to operate within a maritime setting and enabled by such vessels to actually do so. Essentially, for the Army to contribute to generating a powerful, necessarily joint amphibious task group. However, an amphibious task group is only one aspect of a much greater design challenge for the Army and indeed the Defence Force. Mastery of land, air and sea is no longer sufficient for modern Defence Forces. Operating across multiple domains is essential to success. And let me explain. The idea of a maritime strategy is often discussed and just as often can be misunderstood. In 2013, the then Defence White Paper mentioned maritime strategy 10 times. It devoted a section to it. It discussed it, but not necessarily clearly defining the term. It's not a naval strategy. The British strategist Julian Corbett offered a very useful definition a century ago in his 1911 work, Some Principles of Maritime Strategy. He said, by maritime strategy, we mean the principles which govern a war in which the sea is a substantial factor. He stipulated that maritime strategy is about the relationship between the Army and the Navy in a war plan, and that the outcome of such a strategy necessarily has a terrestrial focus. He said, since men live upon the land and not upon the sea, great issues between nations at war have always been decided, except in the rarest cases, either by what your army can do against your enemy's territory and national life, or else by the fear of what the fleet makes it possible for your army to do. I suspect army chiefs have rolled out this magnificent quote here at Lowy and like institutions for nigh on a century. Updated to include the essential third force and its control of the air, what more is there to say if you're the chief of the army? However, Corbett would not write as emphatically today as he did those years ago. Technology has pushed us beyond consideration of the relationship between land and sea, and it is pushing us beyond thinking about simply a maritime strategy. The application of coercive national power hasn't been solely bound by the geographic domains of land and sea for a century. Progressive technological innovation first gave us the air domain and air power. 50 years ago, space became and remains the high ground in intelligence, surveillance, geolocation, and synchronization. 20 years ago, cyber emerged, and its full implications are as yet undiscovered. Perhaps 20 years from now, just a blink of the eye in defense planning terms, perhaps artificial intelligence may be next. Now, most scientists in the field think it's actually 10 years away, so I'm being conservative. Innovation in today's non-geographically bound domains, air, space, and cyber, is driving connectivity and complexity across the Indo-Pacific region. It's bringing the region closer together and more tightly networked. And I think it means the idea of an army for a multiple domain strategy, rather than for a maritime strategy, might be a more useful, holistic concept. Paraphrasing Corbett, such a concept could mean the principles which govern a war in which the sea, air, space, and cyber are a substantial factor influencing and being influenced by the land. Today I want to explore this idea, just noting our strategic interests in the Indo-Pacific, examining some factors which I think shape that environment, and then look at the implications for the Australian Army. Our defence white paper affirms three equally weighted strategic defence interests. The secure, resilient Australia with secure northern approaches and proximate sea lines of communication. A secure, nearer region encompassing maritime Southeast Asia and the South Pacific. And a stable Indo-Pacific region and a rules-based global order. While the phrase Indo-Pacific is only mentioned once, all three interests are clearly set within and against that regional context. The White Paper continues to see beyond purely geographic constructs to consider more broadly our interests. In doing so, it affirms an old but enduring strategic concept for our island nation. In 1902, General Edward Hutton, then Commandant of the Military Forces of the Commonwealth, stated, he said, "The defence of Australia cannot, moreover, be considered apart from the defence of Australian interests. Australia depends for its commercial success and its future development, firstly, upon its seaborne trade, and secondly, upon the existence, maintenance, and extension of fixed and certain markets for its produce outside Australian waters. It therefore follows that Australian interests cannot be assured by the defence alone of Australian soil. The pursuit of our interests, global or otherwise, has always been within and through the geographic construct of the Indo-Pacific. But this region bears little more than a passing resemblance to that Indo-Pacific of 1902. Although the region is defined by two oceans, it's unhelpful to think of it in a traditionally cartographic sense. If we look at the oceans in isolation, we can be misled. Their scale and size are overwhelming, but the true story of the Indo-Pacific is not one of vast, watery maritime deserts. Rather, it is one of crowded, dense, and rich areas of human endeavour. Some facts illustrate this story. It is not just the oceans that are large. The region contains the most populous nation on earth, the largest democratic nation on earth, and the largest Muslim majority nation on earth. 8 of the 10 most populous states are Indo-Pacific nations. Over 50% of the world's people live here. The region encompasses 12 members of the G20. The three largest economies in the world are Indo-Pacific nations. And highlighting the inherent diversity of the region, so are 10 of the world's 14 smallest economies. Linked to the volume of trade and economic activity, the busiest international sea lanes are in the region, as are 9 of the world's 10 largest seaports. The region is also heavily militarized. 7 of the world's 10 largest standing militaries and 5 of its world's declared nuclear nations are in the Indo-Pacific. So we might reasonably conclude that the story of the region is one of size, big oceans, and an equally big scale of human endeavor. But I still think that this is insufficient. Correct, but insufficient. These two factors in combination infer a story about the littoral. And the activity within the littoral is perhaps the unifying and definitive narrative of the region. Dr. Peter Dean of the Australian National University at their Strategic Defence Studies Centre drew on Michael Wesley's recent work when highlighting the significance of the littoral at a conference of regional chiefs I hosted in Adelaide last month. He noted 70% of the world's population and virtually all centres of international trade are in littoral regions. Among the 63 most populated global urban areas, 72% are located on or near the coast, 2/3 are in Asia. In the Indo-Pacific area, 3/4 of the population live within 200 kilometres of the coast. In this zone reside 80% of its cities and most of its vital infrastructure. Robert Kaplan tied all of these facets together in his 2010 book, Monsoon, saying, "It is in the littorals where global issues such as population growth, climate change, sea level rise, shortages of fresh water, and extremist politics acquire a vivid geographical face." The concept of the littoral serves to tie Corbett's story of the sea with the story of the land and the human endeavour it supports. But you will recall I asserted earlier that technology is eroding this construct. I think we need a 21st century concept of the Indo-Pacific new littoral, one in which we see further than the physical relationship between land and sea. The air, space and cyber domains abut and wash over the land and the societies in the Indo-Pacific to an even greater extent than the oceanic littoral is its boundary. The new littorals are ubiquitous. They stretch our conceptions of how a littoral is delineated. Their pervasiveness challenges traditional ideas of sovereignty and borders. They suggest that physical distance does not mean what it once did. Understanding the impact of these new littorals will be important to pursuing our strategic defence interests, indeed our interests in the Indo-Pacific. And we won't be alone in doing so. For example, a recent draft concept paper in the United States noted that they will have to confront adversaries not only in the air and on land, but on the sea, in space and cyberspace, as well as in the electromagnetic spectrum and in the area of human perception. But the proliferation of domains and their interaction are not the only technological factors germane to this discussion of the littoral. Emerging developments in military science and technology have been well canvassed publicly. There will be broad familiarity to most. Capabilities that emerge from things such as digitization, heightened precision and lethality, stealth, miniaturization, electromagnetic and directed energy weapons, hypersonics, automation and autonomy. We are witnessing a next wave of military technological development. And perhaps we're only at the edge of understanding what these technologies might really mean for security and stability. It can be hard to determine the true nature, impact and timing of science and technological change when you're in the middle of it. I see broad agreements among practitioners and theorists alike that we are probably at some sort of inflection point. Technology is changing the character of the contemporary military problem. This suggests the need for innovative operational concepts. But the two don't necessarily follow. The 19th century provides a really useful example here. Industrialization brought railways, weapons with rifled barrels and rapid fire capability, steel-hulled ships and tin food. Each of these innovations had an impact on the possibilities, conduct and character of war. Yet grimly, first in the US Civil War and then in the First World War, the full impact of these technologies was not appreciated. The Army wants to believe it is alive to this trap. It is one of the reasons we've recently reinvigorated our thought and research capability through the creation of an Army Research Centre, but only time will tell if we are successful. However, it may be non-military applications of technology which are having and will have the biggest impact on the Indo-Pacific. The global digital commons are increasingly complementing established international sea and air lanes, not in the physical trade of goods, but with the equally valuable trade in services, finance, information and influence. And the digital and physical commons are coming together to shape supply chains and deliver even greater connectivity. In doing so, they are further impinging upon our concepts of geography and sovereignty. The author and international relations scholar Parag Khanna asserts in his new book, Connectography, Mapping the Future of Global Civilization. He says, supply chains and connectivity, not sovereignty and borders, are the organizing principles of humanity in the 21st century. A country cannot change where it is, but connectivity offers an alternative to the destiny of geography. This leads him to conclude, somewhat controversially, global order is no longer something that can be dictated and controlled from the top down. I know Khanna's view aligns with the inferences of the new littoral I've been speaking of. It builds upon the idea offered by Ian Morris in his 2010 book, Why the West Rules for Now. Ian says, rising social development has always changed the meaning of geography, and in the 21st century, development will rise so high that geography will cease to mean anything at all. A very bold claim. The idea of either a new geography or of geography being rendered obsolete by technological and social development is pervasive in contemporary literature. It is an idea that demands attention by defence planners with a sense of geography derived from the study of Clausewitz, Mahan and Liddell Hart. And while it requires further thought, it must be balanced against another current demonstrated reality. The actions of assertive states in Europe and the Indo-Pacific suggest that with the important physical facts of geographic proximity These facts still matter, and I suspect they always will. While clearly impacted by globalization, as suggested by Kana and Morris, the Westphalian era hasn't quite done with us yet. And there is another observation which needs to be made with respect to the impact of technology on the Indo-Pacific. It is that that impact isn't even for every nation state or society living with wholly integrated lifestyles in the global food supply chain. There is one in which the population are largely living in subsistence existence. Both have risks of disruption, but the risks manifest themselves in very different ways. The same is true of military technology. As US author and polemical television commentator Ralph Peters observed in 1999, technologies come and go, but the primitive endures. The weapons we face in the region from potential adversaries are diverse and potentially at opposite ends of the spectrum, from directed energy weapons to box cutters, hypersonic ballistic missiles to improvised explosive devices. All are or can be in play. For every leading edge system fielded, there are systems 50 years old and everything in between. Different layers of embedded technology and national capability have operational implications for joint and coalition force cooperation as leading edge and trailing edge technologies are fielded together. The evolving Indo-Pacific region is one in which traditional concepts are challenged by the connectivity and complexity of modernity and its enabling technology. This is not new. The Indo-Pacific has always been connected to some degree and complex to a larger degree. What has changed is the scale and uneven application of these effects. Connectivity has broken down traditional boundaries, suggesting new paradigms for how we might view things such as the littoral. Digital technology has not only enabled trade and commerce, it has increased and democratized international, transnational, social and cultural connections. Ideas are transmitted easily and quickly, but transmission of an idea is not the same as acceptance. Social, cultural and national identity is being reasserted in response to the homogenizing forces of globalization in some places. Connectivity is heightening rather than diminishing complexity in the Indo-Pacific. So, what are the implications of all this for the Australian Army? Connectivity and complexity suggest many, but three are paramount. The first is the ongoing utility of land forces and land power. Notwithstanding the proliferation of technology and the associated emergence of new domains, war without submission requires decision on land where people live. The need for Orwellian rough men and women is not going away anytime soon. War is a contest of skills settled by close combat, and it's that enduring responsibility of the army. However, the context in which that contest takes place has and continues to change. This takes me to the next major implication, the operational experience of the new littoral. The fact that our strategic defence interests lie within the Indo-Pacific means it will not suffice for the Australian Army to remain a continental army as we have been for most of our history. But the context of the Indo-Pacific means it is also unsuitable to simply be an army for a maritime strategy, although we must be that as well. The use of force and coercion will increasingly be generated and delivered across and with reach by and to all of the domains of land, sea, air, space, cyber, and soon possibly, as I said, artificial intelligence. A next domain, perhaps, because it may no longer be a human domain. Multiple domains is a present, not a future problem. US Marine Corps doctrine conceives operations 200 kilometres inshore. Long-range land and sea-based surface missiles can strike far beyond the littoral horizon. Cyber operations have and do shut down countries or elements of their critical infrastructure and armed forces. The Army and more broadly the Australian Defence Force needs to be able to influence and shape effects from and across these multiple domains, as other protagonists will seek to do against us. This is why mastering joint operations is even more important and much harder than ever before. We need to generate, coordinate and anticipate multiple cross-domain actions and reactions. No one service or domain can or will have a monopoly on success. Variations in technological capacity across the region require a force to have the agility to operate across that continuum from the high tech to the low tech. Perhaps simultaneously, the Army and its partners now have an integration challenges across five domains rather than one or two and many layers of technology. The Clausewitzian trinity of passion, chance and reason in war will be deeply affected by, but won't go away, will be deeply affected by both digital connectivity and the speed it brings. We need new concepts to deal with an adversary's weaponization of information and influence. How to prosecute a war in a transparent world and cope with the thousand voices of opinion that will surround the point of battle will be even harder for the modern and future commander. Control of tempo has always been an important factor in war. It must now be managed across different environmental domains, moving at different speeds. This will affect us and also our adversaries. Those adversaries who operate below our technological threshold may effectively be operating in another dimension. Despite seeking a technological edge, we will need to retain the ability to operate in a digitally and technologically deprived or denied environment. We will still have to do and deal with low-tech primitive. Our dependence on the digitally assured connectivity of the global supply chain is a modern case in point. How does a high-technology military or society such as Australia function if those supply chains are disrupted or denied? How do we build resilience against those possible eventualities? Connectivity becomes something to be protected and denied an adversary. Perhaps future conflict in the Indo-Pacific will require greater thought about the development and use of indirect approaches. These may be less disruptive to the vital maintenance of global connectivity now essential for supply, services and finance. The third major implication I see for the Australian Army is a philosophical question regarding our people, technology and systems. The Navy and the Air Force have traditionally and appropriately operated platform systems. That is, they have acquired technology, ships and aircraft, and then applied their people to those technologies. The Australian Army has been a people-based system. We have recruited and trained our soldiers and applied technology to support them. For the Army, technology is not an isolated thing. It achieves its effects through application, enabling the right people and their endeavours. Increasing sophistication and the need to use technology across multiple domains will require Army to change our approach. A key question for me is getting the balance right while retaining the ability to fight and function across all of the challenges that we might confront. Army will probably adopt a hybrid model. Rather than manning the technology like the other services, we might settle on an approach of partnering with technology. Now, let me explain. An example is offered by Garry Kasparov in the New York Review of Books in February 2010, and it illustrates how partnering can work. Most are familiar with the matches Kasparov played with IBM's Deep Blue computer in the 1980s and 1990s. In later experiments, students were partnered with laptop computers to play chess against supercomputers more sophisticated than Deep Blue. The results were interesting. It was found that the combination of a strong student laptop and an inferior process of partnering would beat a supercomputer. Perhaps more interestingly, it was found that a weaker student laptop and better partnering processes also beat the supercomputer. In the face of the rapidly growing ability of machine learning and machine autonomy, this suggests a path for land forces. Rather than the future being about soldiers versus machines, it will be about soldiers and their machines. Such a hybrid approach may maximize the relative advantages of both soldier and machine in future fighting systems. Australia's strategic defense interests in the Indo-Pacific region present the Australian Army and the nation with continuity and change. Continuity that affirms the duality of geography and interests as drivers of Australian national security thinking. Change insofar as technology and its innovation are affecting the meaning of both geography and interests within our region. The Indo-Pacific is denser, richer and closer than it has ever been. The old concept of the Indo-Pacific littoral as a distant boundary where social, cultural, commercial, political and military interactions occur has been dashed. The new littoral is immediate and it is where we live. Necessarily, this means the tide must turn on concepts of how we employ national power in pursuit of our society and security interests. Old ideas of continental and maritime strategy are dislocated. They may be rendered moot by the impact of technology and globalization on geopolitics. The same technological wave drives the need to change military thought. This is more complicated than just embracing everything high tech. For a start, that's unaffordable and unaffordable for all states. A new and greater disparity will emerge between the technological haves and the have-nots. The distinction between these might not be as clear as you think. You will recall my earlier point about the mix of leading-edge and trailing-edge technologies that will make up most of the militaries in the first half of this century. These variations will present gaps and seams in military forces that an astute adversary will exploit up and down the technological spectrum. And there will still be those who, by choice or necessity, go for the primitive, such as a socially networked, lethal, time-patient and resilient force, or one operating free of the strictures of globalized ethics, laws and norms. From space-based military effects to machetes, the Australian Army and its partners will need to address them all. Our Army is aware of the need for change in approach. The Defence White Paper sets us a challenge well beyond the continental force of today. Some things we can see now. The linear progression typical of military practice is an uncertain path. Our security interests in the 21st century Indo-Pacific will require thinking in multiple domains and acting effectively in those domains. We also know that we cannot rely on technology alone. Technology works best when enabling or partnering human endeavour. And ultimately, I think it is the human part of war, rather than the scientific part, where the answers lie. Human innovation and partnership created the problems we face. Human innovation and partnership will be the key to solving them. The Australian Army will be looking to our joint force, our whole of government colleagues, our allies and foreign friends, and institutes such as the Lowy Institute to join us in thinking and building our security future in the Indo-Pacific. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Angus. That was a really rich speech, and it gives us lots to chew on. And Angus has kindly agreed to take questions for about 25 minutes, so please get your questions ready. Let me kick off with one. You mentioned allies and partners at the end, but you didn't talk too much about alliances during this speech. Do the changes that you talk about, the changes in technology, connectivity, intelligence, cyber war, and so on, do these make our alliance with the United States more or less relevant? It's certainly been, as I said in my introduction, this idea of coalition military operations around the world has been a constant feature of the Australian Army's history. Do you see this continuing in the future? Does connectivity make the alliance less important or more important?
I think it makes it more important, definitely more important. Now, I would give that some context. You want as many friends as you can have. And Australia has not, and nor should we wish to find ourselves fighting alone. And when we're working in alliance, we're working at the deepest level of international relationship and with the greatest sharing and opportunity to value add across the skills and capacities of both our nations, whether it's alliance with Australia and the US, Australia, US and New Zealand. I am a very strong supporter of that alliance and of the strength that it has provided to Australia for many, many years and that I think it will provide for many years into the future.
Let me ask you one more question because I haven't yet seen the flurry of hands that I know will greet us any second. Let me ask you about technology and let me quote something I heard you say recently. You quoted Star Wars and you said a little while ago, as you said, as you know, throughout the Star Wars universe, R2-D2s have proven to be far more resilient and long-lasting than any Death Star built by the Empire. Now, I know you meant R2 units there because R2-D2 is a specific R2 unit. But let me ask, what did you mean by that? And what does that mean for huge platforms like, $50 billion submarine platforms, for example? Are they Death Stars that maybe are not necessary in a world of cheaper, more resilient technology?
I have, I think, on occasions been misquoted by assumption based on my comment with regard to the R2 unit. Clearly a Star Wars expert here. I wanted to point out that you need both, and you need to understand where you need different choices. In a land environment, dispersion and initiative and action by individuals operating connected but with a coherent sense of the whole is a much safer place to be than concentrated and targetable. That's because we can disperse in a land environment and because our adversaries can either take advantage of us or not if we allow that to be the case. Operate below the ocean and you have one choice. Work together, work in a survivable hardened steel tube or it won't work at all. Those choices are very, very limited. I think that what we see in the acquisition of advanced submarine technology is a very, very important strategic component of Australia's defence. At the same time, I recognise that in land systems, we need a combination of both protected manoeuvre, networked systems, and a capacity to both operate and operate against those kinds of swarming effects that an R2 unit or a UA, an unmanned aerial vehicle might confront us. So to me, it's a combination. There isn't one silver bullet, and you need a balanced force that is able to both prosecute your interests but also present your potential adversaries with multiple dilemmas in multiple environments.
Anthony Bubalo.
Thanks for your speech. The last 15 years, Australia and many of its allies have been fighting counterinsurgency, essentially counterinsurgency, counterterrorism, military campaigns. You hear a lot of militaries talking now about how there's a need to shift to regain some of the kind of conventional warfighting skills that have degraded as a result of that. The problem is, of course, that we're still fighting those counterinsurgency and counterterrorism campaigns whilst at the same time trying to prepare for future more conventional conflicts or conflicts of the type that you described. How do you do both?
We do both, and we have actually been doing both for pretty much the life, certainly of the Australian Army, and I think more broadly of the Australian Defence Force. Let me give you some examples. On occasions, my soldiers might ask either, why are we doing a higher-end conventional warfighting exercise, or why are we doing more of a development assistance capacity building activity or training for such an activity. You go back to Vietnam, you go further back to Korea, you go further back to perhaps Borneo in the Second World War, you go further back to Palestine in the First World War, and a combination of conventional operations and indigenous capacity building has been part of the story of military service. As I say, you can't have too many friends and you can't have too many partner forces that working together, you are stronger for the whole. And so we have come into a modern era of that same model of not having a choice, but needing to do both and learning how to build what would be described as the foundation skills of a higher end warfighting capability, but also being able to maintain and progress lower-end counterinsurgency-style operations. A well-trained soldier is trained in the Australian system to be able to adapt and agilely move between the two. We are not large enough to have single-issue or single-theme experts that only walk and don't chew gum.
Ewan.
Thank you, General Campbell. Ewan Graham from the Institute. You talked a lot about, gave prominence to the maritime domain, which especially in context of mentioning Julian Corbett brings a warm, fuzzy feeling, but I'm hardly neutral on the topic. You mentioned the amphibious force concept. To what extent does that imply an expeditionary vision for the ADF in the wider region? You mentioned the word expeditionary once in your address. What's your comfort level with that term? particularly in view of some of the associations it has, both political and also against some of the emerging technologies that you also outlined as challenges ahead.
Sure. I appreciate that there are different listeners who might imbue that word with different meanings. I think that we conducted an expeditionary operation to serve in the First World War in Europe, in the Middle East, and in the Pacific. I think we did it in the Second World War, and we did it in all of those subsequent wars. So I simply see it as a term describing a capacity to project force in different forms that might be required to pursue our national interests. I am very strongly of that view that we ought to be able to do so. Our interests are, as I described, well beyond the boundaries of our territory, as are all nations. And so the introduction of the landing helicopter dock ships is a next step in being able to build a range of choices for government in order to do that. And perhaps without imbuing that word with any particular meaning, I am expressing a capability to project our military force, combine with others, and work on dealing with security issues beyond our territory.
Alan DuPont was the next hand I saw.
Yes, Alan DuPont from the Institute. Angus, I'd like to pick up on your point about sort of the multiple domains of warfare in which we have to fight, or we will have to fight in the future. And just going back historically, it's clear that the army evolved to fight battles, wars on land, and then we went to the sea and we went to the air. We had a navy and an air force, right? So is it logical to assume that in future we might have a space force and a cyber force different from the army, navy and air force? How would you see these two new domains of warfare being different structurally from those of the past? So in other words, are you going to define yourself out of existence in the next 20 or 30 years, or do you think there's still a role for army?
Yeah. Maybe army should just run cyber and space. That would be the...
Alan, there is room for all, and I certainly don't pitch for some monolith effect, and certainly not a monolith land effect. As I noted in my speech, I think the army quite legitimately will have its work to do, as will the other services. I do think that we will build and strengthen areas of cyber capability, as we will strengthen areas of our ability to utilise and gain the value from space systems, not necessarily our own space systems. Importantly, though, in structures, I would prefer to see something that saw the development of these effects rightly in a joint space where they are both beneficial to all and able to be supported by all. The overheads of the historic institutional constructs of Army, Navy and Air Force, I wouldn't necessarily propose repeating separately and in additional stovepipes, but rather let's throw them, generically speaking, into the centre where they are geographically independent and where they can be most valued and the most value can be gained from them.
Angus, can I ask you a picture question about the West. For the whole of the time really that the Australian Army has been in existence, it's been in a period in which the West is the dominant force in the world. And now if you look at the West at the moment, it's back on its heels. You have a character like Donald Trump having a not insignificant chance of victory in the US presidential election. And in fact, on that point, recent Lowy Institute polling showed that 6 out of 10 Australians would be less willing to support the use of force in conjunction with the United States if Mr. Trump were elected president. You have the Brexit result in Britain. You have the rise you have the possibility that someone with the surname Le Pen could be the president of France. You have a West that is much more inward-looking and that has been shaken up perhaps by Iraq and Afghanistan, by the global financial crisis, the Eurozone crisis. And there's this sense that the West used to run the world, but now it's much more insular, much less confident, much less willing to influence the direction of the world. Do you agree with that? Analysis is what could happen that would sort of wake the West up, if you like? Because it seems to me there's still an enormous amount of wealth and power at the West's disposal, but it seems to have lost its mojo.
Sure. Michael, there are aspects of your question that a service chief would tread lightly upon. I think I would rather like to focus, though, on the points. I think that the recurring and demonstrated point that both democratic systems and I think Western systems are extraordinarily resilient and able to reinvent themselves far more effectively and with far less price to be paid than other systems. And so I am not as gloomy or pessimistic about what I see now. And I recognise that by perceptions of perhaps there is an issue to be dealt with, the issue will be starting to be dealt with, whatever that issue might be in both our different systems and in our collective systems. So I'm more of the glass half full. We'll get through this as we did get through many other challenges in the past. Not to say there aren't challenges to be dealt with, very serious issues, but rather to believe in ourselves and in something that has lasted a great many centuries and in the modern form some hundreds of years.
Fair enough. Aaron Connolly.
Sir, Aaron Connolly from the Institute. Thanks for your remarks. I'm curious, you alluded to this this problem of connectivity, and I want to seize upon a particular aspect of that. Mm. Which is what some scholars have called the strategic sergeant, the fact that you have men and women in the field who may be doing things in a tactical mindset, but because it can be broadcast around the world and folks have hand phones that can record these things, it may have strategic effects. How do you ensure in that environment that your men and women are operating in ways that don't have negative strategic consequences, particularly, as you said, when you may be facing adversaries who don't abide by the same rules and laws of wars as the ADF?
Your question is a very real reality now for all militaries, certainly all Western militaries. There's a great deal of attention that is applied to trying to give context, understanding, background, and a sense of the implications to our soldiers so that across the force, junior leaders are better able to, when presented with an unexpected challenge, to navigate a best path. While I acknowledge that with an iPhone or some other form of communication, there will be the unfortunate moment, and there has been through recent conflicts, there are also thousands of very fortunate moments, none of which necessarily become media fodder, but if we're getting the thousand right and occasionally the one wrong, we still have work to do, but at least I think we are moving in the right direction. And so very much empowering, informing and supporting junior leaders is the way to go.
Hannah, I saw next.
I'm Hannah Worth. I work in the economics team at the Institute. So I'm interested, many of the challenges that you talk about require closer cooperation between the economic and security communities in Australia. How do you see prospects for improving that cooperation?
Okay, I think you're quite right that not just in Australia, but in the world, many of the issues that we need to face are not issues that are resolved in one part of society or one element of our nation's power, or indeed of international power. It's about the conversations and acknowledging the contribution and the possibility that others provide. And others can generate in complement with your own efforts. So to me, it's all about connecting with people. And I think in doing so, you get that net collective effect that is more than the sum of its parts, quite literally. You're absolutely right. Economics, security, issues of influence or of information. There are so many aspects that need to work together to realise a sustainable solution to many problems.
Gentleman next to Hannah.
Angus, I'd just like to ask you how you're going in your recruitment, the quality people you want for the Army. Thank you.
We don't have the difficulty in terms of the total number, but we do have a difficulty in some of the specific areas of skill set. And it's either in areas where perhaps the public are not necessarily aware that either Army, Navy or Air Force are interested in these kind of skills, or where we're competing quite directly into wider economic markets. This is always going to be the case. It's true all over the world's militaries that I speak to. It is quite literally a fight for talent and a fight for particular aspects of talent. So we're giving it our best shot, and we're trying to make sure our recruiting methodologies are invigorated and made as effective and as efficient as they can. So if someone wants to, we can move them through that system very quickly. It's hard, but it's worth the effort to get the right people.
Angus, can I ask you a follow-up question on that? The flip side is the question of diversity, I suppose, and that's an issue that preoccupied the attentions of a number of your predecessors as chief. Can you give us an update? We know that the military has had cultural problems in recent years, but can you give us an update on how Army is going in that regard?
Sure. The efforts of my predecessors over a number of years does very vigorously continue in Army under my leadership. And I think it will, because across the senior leadership community of Army, it's very much recognised that if we're not able to draw talent from the widest breadth of Australian society, we're not going to realise all of those critical skills that we need in the force. It is a force, both Army, Navy, Air Force, that is very high tech and is becoming even higher tech in its capabilities. So you'll see, I think, at the moment that Air Force and Navy are at 19.2% women. In each of those services, Army's full-time force is at 12.2%, part-time force at 14.2%. If you take out the infantry, which, after all, did not allow women until January of this year, and I suspect is not the most attractive of corps to serve in, Army's numbers, removing that combat field component, dismounted field component, actually move up to more around 17% women. There we have women across the force at levels from Major General all the way down to private, and we have women commanding helicopter regiments, commanding engineer regiments, commanding signals regiments, commanding intelligence organisations. We have women performing superbly right across our force and on operations as much as in peacetime as well. So it's a story of the rage is being maintained because we want the value that our total population presents to us. And as I say to some of my soldiers, when I speak with infantry companies and ask them how many women did they speak to on their year in Afghanistan in a small valley in Uruzgan province? And of course, they spoke to none, because the women of the villages of isolated rural Afghanistan don't talk to foreign men. And that is just an insight into the value that we weren't realising. But there are so many other aspects to that value. So the work continues.
I'll take two final questions, and I'll take them together just so we can squeeze them both in. Hervé Lemahieu.
Thank you very much, Hervé, from the Institute. I wanted to go back to this topic of perhaps absolute or relative decline in the West. There were some comments made from the UK last month by General Richard Barons, former UK chief of the Joint Forces Command, who basically said the UK is very good at buying expensive military equipment, or at least maintaining it, some signature capabilities, But what it amounts to is preserving the shop window when in fact it wouldn't be able to rebuff even a conventional attack. In the sense, or at least what he's alluding to is a sense of complacency. Mm. 10 years of the war on terror have meant that adversaries have been asymmetric, certainly not conventional forces. We're now seeing a reassertion of conventional military competition, certainly in this region. And the West seems particularly ill-suited at adapting to that. I wonder whether you could comment on that, or whether that's too pessimistic.
And yes, take the last question from this lady, and I'll ask Angus to elegantly join the
Thank
two
you.
Questions
Susan Pond, it is slightly related in that I was going to ask about the... You mentioned that the Chinese military is spending, if I heard correctly, almost as much as the US. And I wondered if you could comment on the, to the extent you can, on the thinking behind the development of the Chinese military in terms of the fields of operation you've spoken about, Army, Navy, Air Force, cyber, etc., etc.
Sure. I think Michael had raised that point in his introduction. Chinese military expenditure and military development is, as you would expect, an emerging great power. And that expenditure is distributed across the wide range of different areas of military effect that both a country of great population, of great territorial scale, and also of very great interest in the world, would be wishing to develop. So across the breadth of activity, air, land, sea, cyber, space, and so forth, you see development there. I am not surprised by that. It is a rich and it is a growing country with very significant interests in the world. In terms then of putting a link together, if I might, I certainly see here in Australia, and I think the Defence White Paper is a very real testament to a recognition of the range of challenges and the very important work to get it right, that there isn't a sense of complacency. And might I add, in my discussions with my UK counterpart, there is absolutely no sense of complacency or comfort that we can just sit around and be good at one thing and we don't have to worry about what the future might be presenting to us. Our white paper is an expression of a great deal of effort to look at how to develop the Australian Defence Force for the range of real-world challenges it faces now and well into the future, and other countries are doing the same. And you know, I like to think, don't write off our own country, don't write off our allies, don't write off the West. It's based on institutions that can build and rebuild and reinvent themselves and have done so for many, many years.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, Angus Campbell has a reputation for being one of the most interesting general officers that Australia has produced, and I think he lived up to that reputation today with a very interesting series of remarks, and then he generously and frankly took our questions. You mentioned, Angus, that countries like Australia will always need Orwellian rough men and women to protect us, but we also need smooth men and women in our military who are able to apply critical thinking to some of these challenges. And you combine the rough and the smooth, if I might say so. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking the Chief, Angus Campbell.
Thanks, Angus.